If there ever was a question of the role Amazon plays in today's publishing world, it's been answered, and it gets answered here on this program almost every week as we learn more about the ways that Amazon is infiltrating itself into the book business. Welcome, everyone, to Beyond the Book. My name is Chris Keneally, and as always, this is our special Friday feature with the editors and writers of Publishers Weekly. And joining me on the line from Publishers Weekly's office is Andrew Albanese, features editor. Andrew, welcome.
Hey, Chris.
Nice to have you join us, as always, for this feature. And it must get to you after a while to always be reporting on Amazon. But they really are the leaders in this e-book movement at the moment. But what's been happening lately?
Well, I never get tired of reporting on Amazon because they always have such interesting things to report on.
I was going to say, Andrew, you always have an interesting take on it too. I mean, this story you're about to talk about has some twists and turns in it. Tell us more.
It sure does. Well, you know, it's been an interesting week for Amazon. First, it became a children's publisher with the acquisition of Marshall Cavendish. Then it infuriated indie booksellers with its price check program, and now it's back to the well today with the Prime lending program. So, yeah, today Amazon announced a new program called KDP Select, and it's designed to woo publishers and authors to participate in the Kindle Store and that controversial Amazon Prime ebook lending program we talked about a couple of weeks ago. So the centerpiece of the KDP Select program is a $6 million annual fund that's dedicated to independent authors and publishers. There's a catch, though. In order to be eligible to receive a chunk of that fund, participating authors and publishers must give Amazon at least a 90-day exclusive access in the Kindle store. So from what Amazon officials are telling us, here's how the program works. If an author or publisher selects the KDP Select option, and they agree to offer their books exclusively in the Kindle store for at least 90 days, those books become eligible to be included in the Kindle owner's lending library, and they can earn a share of this $6 million annual fund, which appears to be capped at about $500,000 monthly. So the monthly payment for each book is then calculated on the book share of the total number of borrows among people who are participating in that program. So in theory, if total borrows of all the participating KDP Select books are 100,000, this is Amazon's example, and an author's book is borrowed 1,500 times, they'll earn about $7,500 in additional royalties. That's a percentage of that $500,000 figure. Enrolled titles, meanwhile, remain for sale in the Kindle store, and authors will continue to earn the regular royalty rates on those sales. Now, as you know, I've moderately defended the Prime lending model so far because I think it could possibly work as a promotion. And since Amazon is paying for the books, I really don't see the harm. But this new program, the KDP program, I find it just puzzling. And I don't really see how anyone except Amazon would see it as viable. You know, for one, most obviously, Amazon clearly is banking on the program getting more popular. But the more popular the program gets, the more competition is going to be for titles, and the smaller the royalties that are going to be paid out to authors and publishers. So that $500,000 may look like a nice floor, and maybe it is, if there's only 100,000 lends that are going out there. But really, it's a cap. Because obviously there's a point of diminishing returns built in. And no matter how many lens the program has, it could have a million lens a month, who knows, the KDP Select program won't pay out more than $500,000 a month. So the more popular the program gets, the smaller the payouts get for authors and publishers. And the other thing is that in any given month, you don't know who you're going to be competing against for that money. So I really don't see this as anything other than a gimmick, pitting authors and publishers against each other. And publishers make out better than authors. If you have one book in this lending library versus a publisher who has 100 books in the lending library, your chance of getting picked up or getting paid are much smaller. But here's what's most troubling to me. Because Amazon refuses to give out any real numbers, authors and publishers don't really even have the data necessary to make an informed decision about whether to enter the program. You know, we don't even know how many Kindles are out there, or how many Amazon Prime customers, or how many ebooks they're really lending. Amazon keeps all this information really close. So, you know, you have to, one Amazon author called it an opportunity to experiment, but I have to wonder, how can you experiment if you don't have all the data in hand? In the coming weeks, we'll be looking at this much more closely and trying to answer that question.
Well, if I can just mention a point that I've heard brought up here, I'm attending the Publishing App Expo in New York City this week, Andrew, and Publishers Weekly is a partner in that program. And it's that lack of transparency with Amazon and others in the app world, the ebook world, that's concerning a lot of people, authors, publishers, and developers. So as you point out, it's something to really watch and be concerned about. Moving on to the ebook world, moving from the ebook world over to the legal side of things, where we can expect the wheels of justice to grind slowly, but we have seen some movement in several cases.
So yes, in the legal realm, just after Thanksgiving, Judge Denny Chin issued a scheduling order in the Google case that suggested that Google was preparing a motion to dismiss the consolidated class actions against them over their book scanning efforts. Chin gave Google a deadline of December 23rd to file that motion. So, there's something to stuff in your stocking, and yet another sign that the Google settlement as we know it is dead. But this doesn't mean that the litigation would end. Paul Aiken from the Authors Guild reminded us that even if Google wins a dismissal, which Aiken doesn't think they will, the original claimants in the Authors Guild suit remain. So a lawsuit would still exist. Now, here's what's notable. In his order anticipating a Google motion to dismiss the class actions, Chin left in place all of the other deadlines he set forth in September for a trial schedule. And Monday, December 12th, is the first of those deadlines, the deadline by which the parties must refile for class certification. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens there. After that, we have a March deadline for discovery, and motions for summary judgment, assuming that there would be motions from everybody, would come in July. So that's really not far off at all. Now, publishers and Google said in September that they were close to their own deal to end the litigation. And frankly, I'm surprised that that hasn't happened yet. But in the next few weeks, we may very well have a much clearer picture of what the final act is going to be in the Google case.
Well, you say final act, but that might be wishful thinking. The other case also involves the Authors Guild.
That's right. On December 2nd, the university libraries that form the digitization initiative known as the HathiTrust filed their answer to the Authors Guild lawsuit against them. Now, answers in these cases are pretty generic documents. There's a lot of admissions and denials and other pro forma answers, but they also lay out possible defenses, and there are many here. On the merits, the libraries claim that they're protected under Sections 107, 108, 109, and 110 of copyright law, for example, the Copyright Act, for example. And procedurally, as state institutions, they invoke state sovereign immunity. State entities can't be sued in federal court, and copyright is a federal issue. And I'm not sure how the AG is proposing to get around this. As you know, in the Georgia State E-Reserve case, which is currently awaiting a verdict, publishers sued four individuals in their official capacities under a doctrine known as Ex Parte Young. But that didn't happen in this case. Also, the attorneys know HathiTrust is a service. It's not an entity that can be sued. So maybe I am missing something, but it does seem to me like there are some problems with the lawsuit as it's currently filed. So the copyright defenses on their merits may not actually get a hearing, but that may be the best thing. I think the Amazon stuff kind of shows that it's better to pay more attention to the future of the book than what libraries are doing with out-of-print books from the past. But maybe that's something you can ask Maria Palante, the new Register of Copyrights, when you talk with her on Monday. You will be talking with her on Monday, correct?
That's what's happening. In fact, I'll be down in Washington, D.C. at the museum talking with Maria Palente, who is the Register of Copyrights now, as well as with ASMP's General Counsel, Victor Perlman, and Cecilia Kang, who reports on technology and IP policy for the Washington Post. We'll be putting some information up on our website about how you can watch that live streaming video online. So if you hear this and are curious about what Maria has to say about various issues regarding copyright, including orphan works and fair use, we hope you'll join us for that. So what else have you got in the magazine this week?
So elsewhere in the magazine, we have our annual feature on African-American publishing. The retail section has a great two-page feature on the many new kinds of sidelines that booksellers are now carrying. And we also look at the controversy around the so-called showrooming, which is especially relevant in light of Amazon's other little controversy this week with its price check program. And we also have two pages in the news section on sleeper hits from larger houses. However, I don't know what this says, but there really aren't as many sleepers this year as you might think.
It's a good point. If we look at the business over time, watching kind of metrics, as you will, including the sleeper metric, there's a new one, is probably a good way to get a sense of the health of the industry. However, it's always good to hear from Rose Fox. Rose, welcome back.
Good to be back, as always.
Yes, well, we have Rose Fox on the line, who is a PW Reviews editor and who blogs at John Reveal. And Rose comes to us every week to tell us about the books that are being reviewed, the ones that might be big hits, that might be sleepers, that just might not make much of a dent. So tell us about those, Rose.
Sure. Well, this week we have a fiction Q&A with mystery author Paul Grossman, whose novel Children of Wrath is set in 1929 Berlin and features a Jewish policeman. And in the interview, Grossman explains that the character is based on a real person, Bernard Weiss, the first Jew who ever rose to the top echelons of German law enforcement. Continuing the theme, we have a highlighted review of Nathan Englander's What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, a collection of 8 stories that meditate on survival and difficult choices in ways both humorous and horrifying. We also have a big review of Girl Child by Tupelo Haussmann, a powerful debut novel about 3 generations of women living in a Reno, Nevada trailer park. In science fiction, fantasy, and horror, we review The Troop by Robert Jackson Bennett, an engaging fantasy of turn-of-the-century vaudevillains who secretly protect the world from encroaching darkness. In romance, we cover My Wicked Little Lies by Victoria Alexander, which is a Victorian romance about a pair of retired spies who are trying to build a future together while hiding their pasts. And there are secrets and spies in the comics section, too, in Who is Jake Ellis by Nathan Edmondson and Tanchi Zanyic, a high-octane thriller with real depth. In nonfiction, we interview Pulitzer-winning journalist Catherine Boo about Behind the Beautiful Forevers, Life, Death, and Hope in a Mumbai Undercity. She talks about swimming in a lake full of sewage to understand the experiences of the city's garbage sellers. Now, that's real immersive journalism.
Absolutely. I suppose that's what gets you a Pulitzer Prize, after all, is really committing yourself to the subject. You've also got reviews of 2 major history books. I enjoy history myself. What are we looking at this week?
We have America's Great Debate by Fergus M. Bordowich, which digs up the roots of the Compromise of 1850 that temporarily staved off civil war in America, and 1616, The World in Motion by Thomas Christensen, a thematic exploration of a single year around the world that covers the Dutch East India Company, the emerging voices of women as writers, Kepler's calculation of the laws of planetary motion, and everything else that was going on in 1616. We also cover the lifespan of a fact in which essayist John DeGatta and fact-checker Jim Fingal debate the nature of truth and the ethics and pragmatics of journalistic responsibility and literary license. We have a religion section this week. It covers Steve Brown's 3 Free Sins, in which the radio talk show host explains that he wants to be as outrageous as God and encourage Christians to feel truly forgiven and redeemed. We also review Lauren F. Winner's Still, Notes on a Mid-Faith Crisis, a lyrical essay collection infused with a circumspect honesty that conveys both intimacy and privacy. In children's picture books, there's a rave review of Hans My Hedgehog, in which author Kate Coombs and illustrator John Nichol turn an obscure Brothers Grimm fairy tale into a warm and witty story. We also cover 12 board books for the very youngest readers. In children's fiction, we have Patricia McLaughlin's Kindred Souls, a standout portrait of a child and grandparents relationship, and Francesca Leah Block's Pink Smog, Becoming Wheatsy Bat, the prequel to her fantastic genre-shifting Wheatsy Bat novels.
Rose Fox, thank you for that preview of the week's reviews coming up in PW. As always, we enjoy hearing about them, and that title in the children's picture books, Hans My Hedgehog, an obscure Brothers Grimm fairy tale. That sounds very inviting. I'm looking forward to trying to find that in a store myself. And Andrew Albanese, thank you for joining us with the latest news from Amazon and the courtrooms.
My pleasure as always.
It's our regular Friday feature we call PW's Week Ahead, as always on Beyond the Book every Friday. You can like Beyond the Book on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and subscribe free to our iTunes podcast series, or join us online at copyright.com/beyondthebook. It's a presentation of Copyright Clearance Center, the world's largest broker of licensing for all manner of materials, from books and journals to newspapers and blogs. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.